S. versus Milwaukee Public Schools, and Mr. Spitzer Resnick, you lead off. Yep. No, we're not going to make this the last case of the day. I mean, as oppressive as you may think the inquiries are here, we do try to put related cases together.
Everyone else can go and have lunch.
There are many related issues in our cross appeal. The primary issue, however, is class certification. Of course, jurisdiction was an issue in both appeals.
Well, you better focus on jurisdiction here.
I will certainly focus on jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is actually pretty clear. MPS filed prematurely. It argues, and we have to argue that piece in this second appeal because that's what demonstrates. It's the same argument. Our appeal, the August orders of the court, which were clearly timely, assuming those are appealable orders, and MPS never appealed those, not even after the fact, are what really set the June decision into motion.
Well, you're not really appealing those either.
Yeah, the June decision is the injunction, right?
No, I don't believe that it is. And I don't believe it for two reasons. Number one, first of all, the court clearly contemplated post-June disputes, ordered the parties to try to agree upon independent expert or special master, and here's what's really key here, try to agree on class notice. MPS continued all this late date to try to narrow the class. That is as substantive as you can get. You can't get more substantive in a class action.
Right, but those are issues that relate to the implementation of the orders contained within the June order, which was in the effect of or in the form of an injunction because it made global remedial orders against the losing party here, you know, subject to hashing out the details of who the monitor would be.
And who would get a remedy. And from the plaintiff's perspective, nothing could be more important. And in fact, I would argue from the defendant's perspective, nothing could be more important. They've thrown out numbers of $12 million, $40 million. If they had succeeded in that argument that took place between June and 9, maybe we'd only be discussing $50,000, because they made the argument that the only members that were entitled to relief were members who were still students at MPS. Judge Rovner has actually quite rightly pointed out that don't we have to worry about, you know, how long this has been? Well, sure, we have to worry about it. But there is no question, based on the court's August decision, that those students have a right to a remedy. They have a right to remedy. Let me ask the court this. If the district court, if we were here today, had not issued its August orders, what would MPS be required to do under this so-called injunction? Absolutely nothing. An injunction tells a party, you must do something. The clock didn't start ticking. It's that simple. It only started ticking in August. And it only started ticking when those dual orders were issued.
Okay. So here's my concern about your proposed definition of the class. It's that it seems to sweep in virtually the full range of IDA issues into the litigation and more or less seeks to make the district court the superintendent of special education for the Milwaukee Public Schools. Why wasn't it appropriate and prudent for Judge Goodstein to draw a distinction between predetermination issues related to child find, which by their nature either cannot be addressed in individual due process hearings or are much more difficult to do so, and post-determination issues that arise after children needing special education services are identified?
That distinction, and here's one point where we'll agree with MPS, is found nowhere else in the law. Now, arguably, it is an important due process distinction, and certainly when we were up here for round one, we accept, and Judge Goodstein made, I think, on due process grounds, an important distinction between predetermination and post-determination. But what the case law and the congressional record say about class certification, and I think what's important, one of the unfortunate things that I think Judge Goodstein did, and I think what this court, assuming accepts jurisdiction of our appeal, needs to do is remand it for class certification consideration of the other issues we brought. Why? Because Judge Goodstein did not go through a Rule 23 analysis on the so-called post-determination claims. I could stand up here and tell you all the evidence that we brought forward, why it meets it. But the standard, first of all, is very low. There just simply needs to be some evidence, not that you'll necessarily win. Certainly, we can point to the variety of charts and the appendices and the supplemental appendix at page 145. You can see all the issues that we brought forward in the so-called post-determination issues that show the multiple corrective action plans, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 consolidated corrective action plans, as we discussed in the first issue, the first argument. So many systemic complaints. And I think it's also important when considering, was the administrative process exhausted? There are two kinds of administrative processes in the IDEA. One is due process. That's been discussed plenty. The other is filing a complaint with the SCA, which dozens and dozens and dozens of parents did. This issue, and it, you know, the last question, Judge Flom, you asked Mr. Aldana, and he pointed out two of our folks went through due process. Resolve those cases. This is the classic capable of repetition but evading review. How on earth could we bring all these issues if every single time, and how would they ever consolidate to a class action, even timing-wise? I mean, theoretically, we would have to bring whatever numerosity, and I know it's a vague definition, but let's assume at least 15, maybe 20 due processes simultaneously, or at least close enough in time, so that after, oh, wait a second, we won them. We can't appeal. We can't bring the systemic issue because we won them. Capable of repetition but evading review.
That raises an issue that goes back to the jurisdictional question here. You appealed from the August order.
Correct.
And you're not aggrieved by the August order and don't seek relief from the August order.
Correct.
So it's a bootstrapping mechanism to get around the fact that you didn't cross-appeal from the earlier appeal of the June order, which brought up all of the predecessor orders, the class certification order, which is what you want review of, the liability phase order, and the remedies order.
Your Honor, it's only a bootstrapping if you assume that the June order was an injunction. I've argued why we don't believe it was. Because if we were here today and the August 19th orders would happen, MPS would need to do nothing. How is it an injunction if they don't have to do anything? Okay.
Well, it clearly alters the legal status of the parties in a rather significant way.
How? I ask you, Your Honor, when you write this decision,
all that required to be done was that in the next order was that the monitor be appointed, and that's not... Deprived the earlier
with you on the
remedies order of its status as having significantly altered the legal rights of the parties in the way contemplated for injunction status for purposes of interlocutory appeal.
I'm not going to argue with you on if it were merely appointment of a monitor. That's clearly a functionary. However, it was not just that.
It was class notice.
And who's in and who's out. And who's in and who's out. Not just merely like who's going to get a piece of paper. MPS argued, I urge you to reread the court's decision on class notice. He issued two different decisions. One on the monitor. We'll move on from that. One on the notice. MPS argued to narrow not just the methodology of distributing the notice, but who was in the class this many years later. And that's clearly substantive. And in terms of altering the rights of the legal parties, if the August
decision... What was the effect of that argument on the judge?
Ultimately, it didn't succeed, how could we know that?
No, but isn't it a fair characterization that in August we're speaking more in terms of ministerial carrying out of the June order than the substance that's
except for who's a member of the class, Your Honor. This is a class action. That would be the equivalent if it were, let's say, a multiple party case and there were five plaintiffs. And in a post June order, we'll call it, MPS argued that two of those people shouldn't get anything. Nothing.
Well,
how would we be appealing until that post-June order, which decided who's going to get something, okay, which clearly the second August decision did, how would we be appealing? Changing legal rights? If this August decision didn't happen, MPS would be sitting waiting for the August decision. They would have to do nothing.
So MPS files its notice from its notice of appeal from the June 9th.
Correct.
Okay. Why didn't you cross appeal?
Your Honor, because we took the position, as would clearly be noted, we immediately filed a motion to dismiss that appeal. It would have been, and MPS has accused us when it was ultimately this court decided, you know what, we're not going to decide that. Throw it into your briefs. So we then asked the district court for permission. Okay, it was too late. MPS has used that against us. In theory, could we have asked for a motion to dismiss and cross-appealed? I suppose. But as you've heard today, we're convinced the June appeal was premature. Our cross-appeal would have similarly been premature. Why would I submit a cross-appeal to something that we felt was premature?
You still haven't addressed the question about not being aggrieved by the August order.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry. I've been getting multiple questions here.
You don't want that reviewed.
August doesn't need to be reviewed, correct? But it's what clicks the clock in to any prior orders.
It's under the
collateral order doctrine, Your Honor.
Why do you have standing to appeal an order that you're not aggrieved from that you don't want
reviewed? We're not appealing that order. We've never appealed. Our notice of appeal didn't say it. It starts the clock, Your Honor, for us under the collateral order doctrine to appeal. You'll recall,
we asked
for an interlocutory appeal of this class certification. We asked for that. This court said, no, not now.
Right.
Fine. Okay? Assume for a moment. It appears you may disagree. Fine. Assume for a moment. We are correct. The June order was not an injunction. The August order was. When would we get our chance to appeal the collateral order of the denial of that portion of the class cert? What would we be waiting for? Of course, it's a collateral order. That we don't have to appeal if it was final, but it's clearly not given the scope of this litigation, or an injunctive order of August. We don't have to appeal that order in order to go back. Otherwise, we'd be forever foreclosed, potentially. If we won all the way except for one way old order, when would we get to appeal?
Well, no, you wouldn't be forever foreclosed. You file a cross appeal from the appeal that your opponents filed from the June order.
That's assuming it was timely. We assert.
Well, you can maintain the two positions while protecting your client's rights to appeal the earlier certification order.
And our belief is that the result of that would have been this court denies jurisdiction for both claims, and we, as Judge Rovner has already expressed concern, are at it more and more and more and more. That was our belief. So we didn't want to come up here just to get thrown out on jurisdiction. You're right. We could have done it. I'm not going to – look, there's all kinds of legal strategies attorneys can do, not suggesting that what you suggested was inaccurate. But if we're right, the result would have been no jurisdiction. See you again some other time. Oh, and by the way, the August decision's come out now. Now – hold on a second. It's September, nearly a year later. Too late. Sorry, can't appeal the August decision. That's what would have played out if we're right, and if June was premature, August was timely, and we had just crossed appeal the June order. Remember, MPS hasn't appealed the August order. It's not before this court in terms of whether that was correct or not.
Would there have been anything preventing you from cross-appealing from the June order and filing a notice appeal of appeal from the August order?
Your Honor, I'll be honest with you. That would be a new method on me, but I have to say filing second multiple appeals in the same appeal perhaps, I'll be honest with you, this appeal, and I've been up here many times, is the most highly contested procedural appeal I've ever been involved in. I believe you're up to, what, some 60-plus docket items. You know, it's not rocket scientist, Your Honor, or rocket science, excuse me, and I'm obviously not a rocket scientist, but I do the best I can. I think I'm into my rebuttal time.
Anna?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I found the remarks and comments that Mr. Spitzer-Resnick made about the effect of the June 9th to be incredible. For him to suggest that MPS had to do nothing in response to that ignores a 72-page decision. MPS had to take the steps required by the district court. It had to participate in the process leading to the ministerial decisions which were to follow, but MPS couldn't just say, you guys do this on your own, we would be subject to a contempt order by the court. It clearly an injunction. I don't know that you could get, in a case of this complexity and nature, any more clear of an injunction order. Plaintiffs try and argue that the cross appeal means nothing. Obviously, it does. Rule of Appellate Procedure 4 requires that a cross appeal, which is exactly what they're doing here, as Judge Sykes pointed out, they're not appealing the August 19th order. They're exactly doing that. They're trying to bootstrap the 2003 decisions into the June 9th order, which we appealed from, and they did not. They had 14 days to cross-appeal. They didn't. They had 30 days after that to file a motion for an extension of time to file a cross-appeal. They didn't do that within that time. And even then, it would have required a showing of excusable neglect or cause. They didn't come close to establishing that. District Court appropriately reconsidered its initial decision and said that they are too late to file an appeal. But, and this goes to your point, Judge Sykes, there's a reason for this cross-appeal rule, and plaintiffs never acknowledge that. The reason for the cross-appeal rule is so that the parties in the court know what's going to be at issue in the case. And this is a doctrine that at least one Supreme Court said has precedence going back 200 years. It's a matter of judicial handling and efficiency of the case. They can't wait until a time in which they've realized they're too late to cross appeal and then file a notice of appeal from a decision they have no beef about. And that's just, there's a jurisdictional bar because they didn't file a timely appeal or cross appeal, and even then the cross appeal rule serves as further reasons to deny jurisdiction in this case over the plaintiff's appeal.
One point I'd like you to address is the existence of the five consolidated corrective action plans. Don't those plans and their failure to achieve timely corrective action demonstrate that there are, as plaintiffs argue, certain systemic problems at MPS that have persisted despite the individual administrative processes that are available. If those consolidated plans were not achieving the necessary reforms, isn't class litigation the appropriate next step?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, their original motion for class certification went well beyond the consolidated complaints that they keep referring to, and they've really latched onto that. The other thing is you need to look behind those C-caps. Those dealt with, while they sound very impressive, just a handful of individual complaints within a few categories. And so that, to me, doesn't meet any standard of a showing of systemic problems. That, to me, shows DPI was the recipient of complaints about those. It issued corrective action plans. MPS needed further clarification on those, and so it consolidated those action plans. But that doesn't show to me that there was a systemic breakdown in the not only the child fine aspects of this case, but in the entire spectrum of the delivery of special education services that the plaintiffs want to include under one case roof. And I would put it to you, that there is absolutely no precedent, even in the cases where systemic violations have been found or at least warranted a class status, there is no precedent for a age 3 to age 21 in every conceivable component of the IDEA's requirements. To get to my other point, this utterly fails. If the child fine case fails commonality, then this case clearly fails to establish commonality. Where are the common issues of law or fact between whether a student was timely referred because they had a suspension history or whether a student didn't get the speech and therapy services called for under their IEP or whether a transition plan was developed for them when they were nearing the end of their high school career? None of these have common issues of law or fact. And for the plaintiffs to suggest, well, the common issue of law is that these are alleged violations of the IDEA, that is unbelievably circular and simplistic. You have to look at the specific components, the legal requirements that they would need to establish in order to show a warrant of finding of a violation. And there are very few, if any, overlaps between those issues. And so I think the CCAP issue is a red herring. It shows that there were individual problems, and DPI, as part of the system that the IDEA sets up, DPI was exercising its oversight authority to ensure that MPS was complying or would begin to comply with the IDEA's requirements. Importantly, DPI never found MPS was systemically denying students with suspension histories entry into special education. It never found that it was systemically denying students services called for under their IEPs. So while there were individual complaints that DPI issued corrective action plans, and that happens across the country to districts, rural, medium-sized, urban districts like MPS, that alone isn't sufficient to meet the systemic standards required in a single category, and I would say it certainly isn't a showing for the broad class that they're looking to certify in this case. Unless there's any other questions, that's what I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon.
Just a few quick things. First of all, it's not just the CCAPs, and I would direct your attention actually to the other thing I wanted to point out to you, the systemic annual monitoring. This is at RSA 2, the second appendix at 150. One of the reasons DPI was found liable is because they held MPS to an 80% compliance standard. And despite that, what those charts show is the systemic violations year after year in the only school district in the state that DPI saw as so out of compliance it needed to go there and review every year. Not only did they review them every year, they told MPS in advance which schools, which files, and gave them time to clean them up beforehand. Despite that, if you review that chart, you see systemic failure all over the place. If the concern is, and certainly on cross appeal or the second appeal, it's a much broader situation. And again, we urge and we believe the appropriate thing to do is say, did the court exercise its duty to review the Rule 23, these issues? The district court did not, and it needs to do that. We believe there was enough evidence, as I've just described, to do so. If this court is concerned that, wait a second, what's common between least restrictive environment and transition, that's easily remedied by subclasses. It's not that complicated. The rule contemplates it. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. It's been an extensive argument, but the court appreciates the efforts, and the cases will be taken under advisement.